Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. After a week off, we're back to talk watches. This week, we're doing something a little different. Since we revamped Hodinkee Radio a few months ago at this point, we haven't done a Q&A episode, so we're going to do that. I've got some questions that I just want to ask my fellow colleagues myself, things I'm curious about, things that have been on my mind. And some of these were also mailed in or emailed in or DM'd in. So some of these questions are from you, the viewer. So I've probably got a list of 10 questions or so here. If previous experiences are any indication, we'll probably get to half of those at best, three quarters, but we'll keep some in the chamber for future episodes maybe. But first of all, I want to introduce our guest. First of all, it will become immediately clear why this gentleman is on the podcast again, Jonathan McWhorter, our video extraordinaire. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Very happy for reasons we'll get into in just a moment. Next up, we've got client advisor Rich Forden, fresh off of an emergency visit to the U.S. passport office. He is shipping out to Geneva in mere moments, but I had to have him on the podcast for many reasons. But Rich Forden, how are you doing today, sir?
Good, Tony. How are you? Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm doing well. A question for you. Did you get the passport in order? Are you going to be able to raise the paddle this weekend in Geneva?
We're all good. I'm picking up my passport in a mere 2 hours.
A mere 2 hours, and then he'll be straight to JFK, and he'll be in Geneva before you know it. Finally, we've got Malaika Crawford on the podcast once again. Malaika, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, Tony. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just happy to be back. We took a week off. I took a week off, I should say. You guys are in the trenches working, but I took a week off.
Are you happy to be back, Tony?
I'm coming back refreshed. Better than ever, Jonathan. Thank you for asking. But we're going to get into it with you. First of all, Jonathan, I mentioned that we brought you onto the podcast for a very special reason. If you'll recall, guys, we did a 21st century watch draft a few weeks ago. Jonathan, James, Danny, and I all took part. We all built little four watch collections in four separate categories with no brand repeats. And the votes are in, ladies and gentlemen. Jonathan, do you want to guess who won by a mere 3 votes? I'll just tell you, it's you. Congratulations.
Wow. Thank you, Tony.
Congratulations, Mr. McWhorter. You won. Let me just give you the quick rundown of the watches that you picked that won you this very coveted title.
I knew there was a reason I was here.
Did you get him a prize?
I think this is my prize, is I get to come back.
I think Mark won a couple of months ago when we did one, a few months ago. So I guess next time you're in New York, the title belt will transfer custody from Mark to you. So congratulations for that. Let me just tell you real quickly the watches you won with. So first of all, you chose, as you'll recall, the Explorer 2 16570 with a black dial. After that, for your dress watch, you chose the Lange Saxonia Thin with that blue kind of speckled white gold dial. Your complication was the Vacheron Constantin Le Historique triple calendar. And then finally, for your budget, you chose the ever trustworthy G-Shock 5600. I think you wanted the one that was the atomic clock syncing one.
Which yes.
Maybe that might be 5610. I don't know. I don't know if it has a different reference, but it's a watch in a shape we all know and love. So, Jonathan, congratulations.
Thank you, Tony.
I wanted to talk just briefly with Rich and Malaika. You know, you guys obviously listened to that episode and re-listened, I'm sure, multiple times. Any watches that you guys think we missed from our sort of overview of 21st century watches and watchmaking that you feel like would have been important to include?
I feel like anything I say is probably going to be so unpopular, but whatever. That's what I'm here for, right?
Well, so what is it up like that? Yeah, geez.
It was sort of quite expected, I feel like, that list.
Boring.
Kind of boring.
I'm sitting right here, Malaika.
Pedestrian,
yeah,
even.
Your pick, it was a little pedestrian. Hang on. Let me just...
Am I blushing? I think so.
Jonathan, yours were stunning choices.
Well, give me something outlandish from the last 24 years of watches that we missed that we should have included, Malaika.
I feel like you should have included an RM, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Which one would you have included?
I personally would probably include like one that works for me out of selfish reason. So an 0701, but I don't know. What do you guys think in terms of like the broader RM world?
For me, it's the Nadal.
I knew you were going to say that.
Well, this is in the realm of watch nerdery. That's like the RM to pick, right? Rich, you have thoughts on RM as well. Which one would you have picked? I think it is a glaring omission to not sort of try to tell the last 24 years of watches.
I mean, it's
RM,
kind of,
to be honest.
Yeah, it's a very like important part of the last 20 or whatever years, even if you didn't like it.
Yeah, Tony, I think it kind of falls on you because among the people on that draft, you were the closest to RM, I feel. I mean, James is not throwing an RM out there, is he?
You'd be surprised. I think the mistake, if there is one, is that we didn't include kind of an indie category this time around. I don't know if that's an omission or I just wanted to kind of keep it tight. I did budget instead. I try to be relatable. I'm kind of an everyman.
Oh, right. Because you did categories. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So we did sport, dress, complication, budget. There was no indie category. I used my dress to do an FP Journe. To me, that's like the other most important kind of independent watchmaker of the past 24 years. Rich will probably come at me with like the Defour Simplicity or something like that. More modern folks, there's the Rekchep, or even an Acrivia if you want. So I think a lot of these sort of omissions, as much as there are any, are the lack of independence. So many of them kind of got started in the late 90s, early 2000s. You talk about Erwerk.
I feel RM is such a glaring omission because it's like something that a lot of people outside of watches know about. Nobody knows what an Erwerk is. Sorry.
sure. I suppose that's true. Anyway. Jonathan, Rich, anything else you want to say about the 21st century and the 21st century watch draft before we move on to today's agenda?
It was a great 24 years for watches, and we just didn't have enough space to pick them all.
Look forward to the next 24 years, huh? Rich, anything else? What's the one watch you would have picked if one thing we didn't pick? What's the sort of first glaring omission from your perspective?
Well, the first glaring omission was already mentioned, the Defour Simplicity. It was, you know, announced in 2000. So it's the most important watch from, you know, this century, but we'll move on. I had a gripe with the AP pick.
Ooh, I think me too. Okay,
the RD2 is great. I love AP professional calendars and the history that ties back into like the 20s with that. I mean, you'll never find a bigger fan of those watches than me and AP's history in calendars. It's the RD3. It's the best tourbillon on the market. It's way better than the RD2. So if there was only one AP, which I understand the rules now, it's one brand only, one watch per brand, I really don't like the RD2 as the pick.
Well, Rich, there's a whole lot more rules that we need a clarification on. So like, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
In my many listens, I got so tired of hearing about the rules that they have just all come out the side of my head.
I actually agree. I agree with Rich. Why would you do RD2 if you could do RD3?
Yeah, that's a stinky pick.
We'll have to get, who chose this? Danny? We'll have to get Danny on the podcast to defend his pick at some
point. Danny's not really an AP guy.
he just chose it because he felt like he had to. Yeah. No, again, this is kind of, for all the reasons Rich mentioned, this is kind of the watch nerd pick of the RD family. Or if you're going to try to choose like the supercar of Royal Oaks, I feel like this is the one. In some ways, because of the ties to the historic QPs and all of those things. But, you know, I'm not going to argue with the RD3 being the quote unquote correct choice either. Guys, today we're doing something different. We've got a bunch of topics to get to, a list of Q&As. Hopefully we'll come through with some exciting new takes. I was out for a week and a half, and I came back to all kinds of news, all kinds of watch stories and new watches and watch releases. And I wanted to just do a bit of a Q&A so that we could run through a bunch of different topics briefly before the day's out. So guys, the first question is something exciting here, of course. It's going to be about Cartier indirectly, but a lot of other brands as well. So let me just read it off for you, and then we'll see who wants to answer it first. So Cartier has had huge success tapping into its heritage since launching the Cartier Privé collection in 2017, reviving one of its iconic shapes every year in limited editions. Other brands, Vacheron and its Les Historiques, for example, has seen similar success. Which brand would you like to see do a similar collection that draws on its history? Similarly, which brand should not do this?
I'll get my obvious take.
Oh, Rich is just ready to go. This is why I tried to choose questions that lend themselves to like not necessarily hot takes, but just well thought out takes that will drive the opinions of the panelists here. So Rich, just please jump in. I love it.
Well, Tony will know this well as some other Hodinkee staffers, but the answer is Movado. They will never do it the correct way, but if they ever did, it would be amazing. Let's just get this out of the way. If you don't know Movado and you think of it as a mall brand or a museum watch brand, buy the book, read the book. You'll see what I mean. If they actually did a privé level collection of some of the stuff from the 30s, 40s, 50s, they'd be a much different brand, but they won't. So we can move on.
Yeah, totally true. You know, they did one watch that was like a subsea chronograph kind of homage in a way. It didn't really land, but they tried. So that's something. But yeah, they'll never do this. You know, I had Jonathan Fair of Brew Watches on the podcast a couple of months ago, and he, as he talked about, started his watch design career at Movado. And I asked him about this, like, do they care about their heritage at all? And he was like, not really. So keep hoping against hope, Rich.
One last thought. I know that they actively buy very, very excellent vintage watches. I know they're an active player in the market. I don't know what they then do between buying them and then coming out with a product, because I've seen that process. Like 5 years ago, they were buying subsea chronographs, and now they came out with something similar, but it's not even close to the original. It's just a dumbed down, you know, modern version. But anyway, brands that shouldn't do it is more of a hot take. I'll leave that to someone else for now and let me think.
Malika, please.
Can I go? Yeah. I actually think no brands should do it, and everybody should stop being so lazy.
I like this. I like this.
Just kidding. I feel like Cartier can do it in a way that the others can't, just because of that sort of like, they're a little bit of a different category, I think. Even though I don't love all of the privé stuff, I just think they're able to execute things in a slightly more elegant way than some of the others, probably due to their like design history. I do think the Jaeger needs a little help, and that collectibles thing was sort of outrageously priced. So maybe they want to try their hand at doing something that's vintage focused instead of selling vintage watches at over double their value.
Yeah. So I'll pick it up there, because Jaeger was mine. I love vintage Jaeger, and they continue to be sort of one of the most confounding modern brands. I love so much of what they do. I love the watchmaking history and, you know, the Grand Maison and the watchmaker's watchmaker and all these sort of things. I wrote about the new Duometer just a couple of weeks ago that they released at Watches and Wonders. Sort of an amazingly complex watch, really cool, even kind of somewhat wearable, quote unquote, for how complex it is. And from the movement, even to the case and the dial work. But there are some things there that it's like, they cut costs in certain ways in the manufacturing that they didn't 15 or 20 years ago. And it's obvious that they've done it right. Like one that I called out in the article is they're not using German silver for this particular movement in the Duometer anymore, which is fine. Like most people probably don't care about that. They just want a Duometer that looks cool. Even little things, like it doesn't have a deployment clasp anymore, which is fine, right? But it's just these little things that it's like, if you're going to give us this Duometer that's going to be this amazing, complicated statement about everything that you are as a watchmaker, like, please go all the way that Lange honestly does. I mean, it's a brand, it's in the same stable, and they're able to do this for the most part. So I'd, you know.
Bit of a different price point there.
Well, sure. But honestly, like the way in which... It'd be fine if the prices at Jaeger hadn't sort of increased so much in the past handful of years. A lot of brands have done this. Just prices have really gone up since, I don't know, since COVID, basically, in the past 4 or 5 years. So it'd be fine if prices hadn't kind of gone up so much. But that's separate from this historic point I wanted to make. Like the last real kind of modern hit, there have been a few, actually. One of which James mentioned in the 21st century fantasy draft we did, he chose actually a Jaeger deep sea chronograph, which is modern and stuff, but like a cool watch with some vintage heritage. The best kind of modern Jaeger has been the tribute to 1931 reversos that they've done, that they started doing in 2011. And they kind of just haven't found their way with the Reverso, in my opinion, in the past few years. The modern collection, for the most part, is not doing it for me. The chronograph accepted, I suppose. I think the Reverso chronograph is a cool watch, but that's not really a heritage play in the way the tribute to 1931 was. I mean, I just want to see like a great steel Reverso that's a heritage inspired watch from them. And they just don't have that right now. And to me, there's no reason that like, there's no reason that the Reverso shouldn't be like maybe not Royal Oak level or Nautilus level or something that everyone knows and recognizes and wants, but like the history is all there. It's a legitimately cool watch, but something is missing in a lot of the modern Reverso catalog. I think they're paying attention to this. Obviously they are, they've done this before. But I just hope they kind of get back to that in some way on a more sort of broad level than what they're doing now.
Rich doesn't like reverses. Is that true?
I'm not a huge fan, no.
Vintage modern or ones, modern? You're just not into them at all?
I mean, of course, vintage ones are great, but I think we were just talking about this the other day. The cases are just really not that well built when you get really old with Reversos. So the dials are always refinished for the most part. If you can find an original dial, like it's literally needle in a haystack stuff. And finding an original Reverso is hard anyways. But those dials are mainly refinished or very poor condition. But yeah, I don't like modern ones either. The dials are really flat. I think they need to change a bit of the dial manufacturing or something. It just does not pop in person, but I like the model.
Well, isn't that sort of like what we're talking about here, is that there's a lot of rich potential in the JLC archive that there is to work with. They weren't made very well back then, but now this is what we want to see, like modern manufacturing with this, you know, these older proportions and stuff like that. It's like I think JLC is a great candidate for that category that they should be doing this and arguably a bit better than they are.
Yeah. And I don't want to make too much out of it because JLC is a modern watchmaker, one of the few that kind of like is pushing watchmaking forward at the scale it is. So I don't want to make this sound like their entire thing should be, please JLC do a heritage Reverso. That's not what they're about. They
sure
like the Duometer is a great example. It's got some modern watchmaking and it's improved upon the idea that they initially introduced in 2007 or whenever it was. So I don't want to sound like we're banging on the door at Licentia or wherever and being like, no, just give us heritage watches, right?
Well, I think Rich is. What Rich wants a better Reverso.
I am. But again, this question is like to the level of Cartier's Privé collection, which JLC could do. It could be a small portion of their offerings and give people like me what they want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Privé is a very small proportion of what Cartier does. A limited edition of a few hundred a year, really, really aimed at hardcore collectors of Cartier or of watches. And that's all we're asking for, I think. Give something to the fanboys, I suppose, every once in a while.
Tony, a brand that should not do this.
This is a good question. Do you have an answer, or Malika, do you have an answer, or Jonathan, while I think
I actually
just a moment.
I have an answer.
Oh, okay, please.
We all have an answer. You guys go first.
I have Patek.
Oh.
Do you want to explain, or do you just want to?
Just drop the microphone there.
I want a reaction first, but I think vintage Patek just kind of sits in its own category. And as many gripes as I have with what they offer today, if they were to go back and like revive some of the Calatravas in like a Privé sense, I really don't think that there would be much reason to do so. It's very easy to go out there and buy a vintage Patek at like a really, really nice level. You know, there wouldn't really be serving something in the same way that Cartier is really, really, really hard to find in good condition. For example, like that platinum Centré that you wrote about, I think that was last year, you know, that's like restored and you just can't find them. That's why they're that expensive. So when they come out with a platinum Centré, it makes sense. But for Patek, I think leaving the history in the past would be the best, which I think they're doing.
Interesting. Malika, your choice?
I definitely feel like AP should not do it.
Yeah,
everybody goes on about like AP dress watches or like jewelry watches or whatever. Don't need to see that.
I don't think it matches the
No.
What the brand is going for culturally and everything else.
It couldn't be further apart. And I have absolutely no doubt that they will not even go there. Like they just, it's like not within their like MO right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to Rich's point, if you want that, they did some of that in the 90s even. But I don't, if the Code 1159, sort of the last collection they tried to launch is any indication, that's not really a heritage play in any substantial way. Although maybe they'll do it on some small level. Remember they did the remaster 01 a couple of years ago. And then presumably it was named the 01 for a reason and there would be more coming. I'm not sure. We haven't seen anything since then, but that's like that was a very one-off thing. For those that don't remember, this is kind of a modern AP chronograph, two-tone, and it's a kind of reinterprets a 40s AP chronograph. And I think it came out to mixed reviews 4 years ago. I can't even remember, you know, at this point, but maybe that's kind of what put a pause on the entire program and made them refocus on other things, as well as I think it came out right around the 1159 anyway. So there was probably just a lot going on and the idea got put on the back burner. So we'll see. I mean, we'll see.
The way they executed the star wheel goes like into your little thought bubble of they're definitely not looking back in that way. Like, they totally. Just like keep it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, when we covered the star wheel, I said like, this is for modern AP, this is probably the best way for them to do heritage. And it was, to me, one of the best uses of the Code 1159 at the time. Others have made the point that it's best when it's a vehicle for complications. And the star wheel is a fun way to do that. But I think that's probably how they'll use their heritage going forward.
I was going to say AP as well, because they fall into a category with other brands that I won't name that I feel like they're planting their flag strictly in their heritage, and they're not really, all they're doing is just making the same thing over and over again. And I want to see new stuff. And all they're doing is focusing on old things at a mass produced scale. And it doesn't feel particularly inventive. It gets stale after a while. And I want to see new things from a lot of brands that are maybe too much focusing on their heritage and not in the right ways, like a Brevet type collection.
We're moving on to a different topic for now. We're going to start with Rich on this one. As I mentioned, Rich is heading to the airport soon to go to Geneva to bid or at least evaluate some watches for clients as a client advisor here at Hodinkee. Rich, as a client advisor, how do you navigate the quote unquote precarious world of auctions in 2024? So for those that might remember, there were, you know, a handful of quote unquote controversies, I suppose, around the auction world last year. Only Watch was postponed. It's happening this year. There was, of course, the sort of Franken Speedmaster that sort of came to light in June of 2023. But Rich, I just want to know, as someone who's actively involved in that world, how do you go about evaluating sales and then the watches that are being offered at these auctions every season?
At risk of sounding like a sales pitch here, the important thing is to, first of all, see the watches in person and speak to collectors or experts in the various fields of the watch you're looking at. Those are really important. That's why I'm going to Geneva tonight to look at the watches in person and advise in that way. The world of watch auctions, is very like insular, which I've learned over the past 5 years or so. The people that are involved in bidding in these auctions constantly are all from like the same group of people. And if you're not talking to that group of people and understanding what these watches really are, and you're just taking the houses at their word, that's where you run into trouble. So it's important to see the watches in person and know someone who can speak to these experts who understand exactly what these watches are.
Yeah, I think to zoom out a little bit, something we just haven't talked about in our auction coverage in the past few seasons that maybe we should just remind people is the entire job of watch auctions is to represent the consignor, aka the seller of a watch. And I think people just at a very fundamental level kind of sometimes forget that, or people that are new to watches maybe still don't even know that. So these people are at the end of the day representing the consignor of the watch and incentivized to get them the best price. Obviously, they want to make sure everyone's happy with the deal, otherwise you'll kind of get problems down the road. But kind of everything, you know, there's the classic saying, I think it's Charlie Munger or whatever, right? Show me the incentive and I'll show you the result. And that's kind of what happens here. And I think to Rich's point, a lot of the so-called controversies that happen are related to a perceived lack of disclosure. And to Rich's even larger point, often this time, this is coming from people that are commenting on social media or in Hodinkee comments or wherever else. They're kind of observers and maybe not actively involved in the auction world on a really meaningful level, like every season talking to this this really insular group of folks. And if you get into it more, you kind of realize that auction houses even like will disclose to their clients more than they kind of list on the listings or in their condition reports. Once you reach out and sort of make a personal connection with their specialists or whoever else it is. So I think there's a perceived kind of lack of disclosure that sometimes is done on the back ends to like trusted clients and folks like that. But people that are just people that are viewing it from the outside looking in more so see this kind of lack of disclosure as more problematic than the folks that are actually in it really see it as. And I think that's kind of like, it all goes back to the incentive, right, that I talked about at the top. But I think a lot of it's kind of overblown, honestly. At the end of the day, it's typical sort of social media fodder. But there are real concerns. And I do think this kind of like perceived lack of disclosure, whether or not it is real, kind of does turn people off from vintage watches, which is unfortunate to me because I love vintage watches for all these different reasons, as does everyone else on the call. And I think, hopefully there's sort of a tide turning, and I think it will, as people kind of expect more of these auction houses and of just private dealers as well. So I think maybe a tide has turned or will turn. But that's kind of just the 30,000 foot, like takeaway that I wanted to leave this question with.
Yeah. My last point here would just be that, in the art world, which many of these auction houses, most of them outside of Antiquorum, are auction houses for the most part. There's a whole world of art advisors in the watch or in that world. There is not that world here in watches, and the houses still act like that world exists with watches. They treat them roughly the same as they treat art. You know, like you say, representing the seller first, and there's no vehicle in the watch world to represent buyers, which is honestly what I try to do and why I'm making the trip and all that. But like, that's not a sales pitch. That's just calling out that there are no watch advisors. There are dealers who go to the auctions and they have their own incentives, right? It's just, the important thing is talking to people that you trust and understanding their incentives, like you say.
Rich, we're going to keep it with you, and then maybe Malika and Jonathan can get in the mix on this one. But why does it feel like no one is talking about vintage sports Rolex specifically right now? Are there value opportunities to be found in this once hot segment of the market?
I'm talking a lot, Tony. I would like to pass the mic eventually. Vintage Rolex, I think the issue is that the prices haven't moved much. Even 3 years ago, the prices were, I got many clients coming to me saying that they're just way too expensive versus what they were 5 years before that. And even though the market has downturned, or there has been a downturn, and sales volume is not as high as it once was, like 3-4 years ago, even two, the prices aren't really moving all that much, and they're moving maybe a couple of grand, but a nice vintage Submariner is still, 20 grand and roughly 15 to 20, depending on how nice you want. That's pretty much the same price level as it was 3 years ago. So we have prices not adjusting to them not being hot anymore, so they don't sell.
But there seems to be still so many of them up at auction. Like anytime I go to a preview, there's just like masses of it. So I guess somebody is buying it.
Well, Malika, I mean, oftentimes you write about these really fun watches, 70s yeah. watches, shapes, colors, blah, blah, blah. But most days I see you are wearing one of the simplest watches ever made, sort of a five digit or early six digit Explorer One. So, I mean, the appeal presumably is there, and it kind of gets to a question I wanted to ask later on, but like at the end of the day, Rolex, it's what you're wearing. So I think the appeal is still there, right?
I think the appeal is still there for most people. And the way that I look at watches, I think, is usually less about what I would wear and more about what I find interesting, which is why I don't really understand the argument about sort of brands like RM or whatever being sort of out of your price range, because I'm not looking at RM or whatever, an expensive AP to think about whether I can wear it or not. I'm just looking at it as kind of an object that I'm into. But I would probably most likely wear the same kind of watch every day because it just works and it's practical and it looks good.
Yeah, something you have to learn to do relatively quickly in this job is appreciate things while acknowledging that you might never buy them or sometimes even be able to afford them, right? That they're just cool objects to exist in the world. And part of our job is trying to translate that. Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail, and that's fine. But I think, yeah, you're totally correct.
Yeah.
I think like these, you know, I don't know if this answers your question or not, Tony, but like when it comes to something like vintage Rolex and like Rolex at auction, like I think to paint with a push broom, like people are bored of it, but obviously people are still into it because there's a lasting thing about Rolex. It's, you know, it's Rolex for a reason, but it's still, it exists right now in an area that most people can't penetrate and it's not really approachable and it's hard for, you know, we can appreciate them if we're existing, but it's not really an area that a lot of people can participate in, which is why I think that maybe some sentiment is faded there, but it's not as interesting as it used to be because you can't, most people can't get there. You can't get into the party. You just kind of look in through the window.
Okay, everyone, the next question I'm going to ask, and now that we're a couple of weeks removed from the official release, seriously, what are your thoughts about the Tag Heuer Kith collaboration Formula One release? Malaika, surely you have thoughts as one that is intimately familiar with the culture.
The culture that every commenter is like, what culture are you talking about? I'm like, the culture with a capital C.
Yeah, capital T, capital C.
Okay. Yes, I have thoughts. They're not as negative as some might expect them to be.
Okay.
Yeah. So when we all found out, like every person in the watch industry has known for like 2 years that this was coming. So it wasn't really a surprise. And there was the whole argument of you should just make them exactly the same as they were. And then I think there was some sort of, you know, speculation as to whether they were going to re-release them in a bigger size, yada, yada, yada. And so actually the Kith collaboration, while it might not be like the avenue I would go down, but I think it makes so much sense for a brand like Tag Heuer to partner with somebody like that. And I think it allows them to kind of get closer to the original model without like stepping too far away from what they're doing in a modern sense. Because you can kind of like use Kith as the excuse or whatever. And they're not making it too big. Like they're not, I think they've done a really good job. And I think collaborating with Kith in this instance makes total sense, especially considering like who they want the target audience to be for this product. And I like the way they've kept it pretty similar to the original specs. Yes, if I hear one more person go on about the price, I'm literally going to shut down. I don't care. It's $1,500. It's not that big a deal. Like any brand like that collaborates with a streetwear company like that is going to price it at that kind of level. So I don't want to hear it.
But that's kind of how this thing sort of works, right? When you want to reintroduce it, maybe something that people have been asking for, it's kind of like a pilot program. Like you make it limited, you make it sort of expensive to, I don't know, like to put it really generally, like kind of test the waters, so to speak, like without doing it exactly the same, because do it like that's a little derivative to do it exactly the same as it once was to reintroduce something. You got to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, they absolutely should not make this part of their like main offering. I do not think they should. I think that would be a big mistake.
Well, can you expand on that for a second? Because part of my assumption was limited edition, let's test the waters in a year or so. Maybe we release a mainline collection that's a little bit cheaper because it's not a Kith collab and it'll be more widely available. This is part of my assumption. No inside information, truly, but I had assumed it.
Why would you do that? Like, people need to stop doing this. And it feels like if they did that, it would kind of be sort of like a moon swatch situation, and that makes things very sad. And I think if you that was a bit harsh, wasn't it? I think if you're trying to kind of get brand recognition and elevate like your street cred, then cool, do the collab, but then leave it alone and get the name out there and get people looking at the brand and maybe try and do some like different things. But I think it would be kind of lazy to just do a bunch of kind of quartz watches that were truly a moment that has passed from the 90s. Like, it is not the 90s anymore.
Yeah. Maybe this is my old man question for you or for anyone else, but maybe my concern as an old man is, or could be.
Wait, you're younger than me, Tony.
I know, but I have an old soul, Malaika. I have an old soul.
The old man question coming while the cat is in the background. Perfect.
Okay. So here's when I got into watches, I don't know, probably a decade ago at this point. One of the things that appealed to me about them was it felt very removed from streetwear, sneakers, all these types of things that like managed to generate hype. And a decade ago, like Supreme was the thing, right? And watches felt so, felt like the total antithesis of that. And now it seems as though one of the lessons the watch industry has learned is that from that whole thing is you need to collaborate to create a moment to drive hype, to drive brand awareness, which will drive sales down the road, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems as though the Kith collaboration, the $1,500 price point, you know, it makes sense in the world of Kith. It doesn't necessarily, the price point I'm talking about, it makes sense in the Kith world totally when a sweater is $800 or whatever it is. It doesn't necessarily make sense in the world of Tag Heuer, but that's fine. It's a limited edition, so I'm not going to be the umpteenth person to complain about price anyway. But my worry or my potential concern is we're leaning into that as the perceived lesson from streetwear and how they've become so popular and so ingrained in the culture, capital C, capital T. And in the meantime, we've lost the original sort of appeal of the Formula One that is the nostalgia play where it was so accessible. It was in malls everywhere. And it got so many people into Tag Heuer and Swiss watchmaking at a time when there had previously been concern that the entire industry was not going to exist a decade from then. So please respond to the old man question I've just posed.
Listen, the way young people consume products today is vastly different to how they consume products 20, 30 years ago. And we just have to like get up to speed with that. And that is what the brands are doing. Tag Heuer is an LVMH brand. And Frederic Arnault, who was like, you know, at the helm of Tag Heuer, presumably during the product development, recognizes that young people today are consuming things like via different mediums. And streetwear is like the largest, just as hip hop is like, you know, probably the kind of largest cultural movement for young people, so is streetwear. And so that's how you kind of like get into the minds of young people today. I think it's like really obvious.
I think it's a good point. Like in the same way that someone is nostalgic for walking into the mall and buying a Formula One in the 90s, some kid in 20 years is going to remember signing up for the drop on Kith and how he was lucky enough to get this rare item. And that's his nostalgia now in 20 years.
It's just totally a different time. Like teenagers like are shopping differently. They're looking at different things on the internet. Like I think we have to like get rid of this idea that kids today are shopping the way we did in the 90s. Like it's not the same.
So does that mean more limited editions?
And the limited edition thing is like in the way that like rappers were always kind of this, like they were figureheads kind of like an emblematic of the success story. And it wasn't necessarily like they bought diamonds or five times in, so you have to. It was like, that's the aspirational product that you can one day have too. Like this falls under that same model. And I just think like people going on about the price or whatever it being like a forced collaboration are sort of missing the point. Like this is for the mainstream. This is like for the kids. This is not support, like, you know, the 40-year-old man sitting at home, like, commenting on our articles. Sorry, but it's true.
I need the youth to come. This is why I need you, Malika. I need you to explain the youth to me. I don't understand it anymore. We're filming this a week or so after the Met Gala. And my question for you, Malika, and others, of course, is quite simple. Have brands, stylists, etc., ruined watch spotting at the Met Gala and other red carpet events?
Yes.
Explain. I can argue it either way, so I'll argue the other way after you give your position.
Okay, look, I honestly, to be honest with you, I don't have that many thoughts on this. I feel like I've spoken my thoughts. Everybody knows my thoughts, including certain brands who are mad at me for my thoughts. Listen, I was never out here watch spotting before my career in watches on the red carpet. I'll be totally honest. I couldn't have probably paid less attention to anything on the red carpet. I'm like looking at what people are wearing, you know, whether it's their clothing or whatever. The thing is that even like their outfits are kind of less organic than they were, say, 10 or 20 years ago. Like, it all falls under this kind of brand hegemony, like pay to play umbrella. So whether it's the watch or the dress or what have you, like, it's all pretty boring these days. And it's sort of less about kind of cool, weird swan dresses on Bjork. And it's like more about Louis Vuitton paying Emma Stone thousands of dollars to wear a dress every time she walks on the carpet. Same goes for Omega. Same goes for Vacheron. Same goes for IWC. Like, it's not organic, but what can we do about it? If I was a celebrity, I'd be taking a check too.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. You know, I'm looking at, just to kind of, I want to level set this a little bit before we get too far into it, but we published a little watch spotting at the Met Gala 2024 a week and a half ago or whatever it was. I'm scrolling through it and I think there are probably just a couple of what I feel are truly organic watches, and everything else was placed by a brand, I would say. I think Kris Jenner's husband, Corey Gamble, I think is a well-known collector, wears his own watches, right? And he's
my
the king
and
right?
queen. My king right. and queen. I'm right. obsessed with the Kardashians. I just am. Sorry, Cara Barrett and myself are constantly texting each other pictures of their watches. And we find them absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And Corey, who else was wearing do you think? I can't remember.
I wanted to pose a question. Jerry Seinfeld wearing a Chanel J12 might be.
I love
that
it.
That legit?
No way.
That's such an odd one, right?
He was wearing Chanel, I think. So I'm
okay.
sure they just
Okay, so they placed it then. Yeah. Okay, the other one I had, maybe John Batiste wearing the Cartier Tank Privé Normal. We saw him wearing a Shapiro on a red carpet this year as well, which is a very watch guy watch. So I feel as though
it wasn't organic. You know why? Because there was a Cartier party at the Carlisle and he was like there and I think he was performing. And so I feel like that was not an organic thing.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. So maybe Corey Gamble is legitimately the only
Corey Gamble, king of the red gold.
Oh, I saw Ed Sheeran was wearing the John Mayer AP and obviously as well. But that's you know, we know that one. So listen, the alternative take, I suppose, Malika, that I wanted to pose to you again as a question, I'm just asking questions here, is at the end of the day, celebrities by and large are just people. Not a lot of them have style. And if they didn't have stylists, they perhaps would not be pushing the envelope in a way forward. Like, these guys in this case wouldn't be wearing small watches, dressier watches, and like pushing the envelope of what is, you know, seen as a quote unquote man's watch. And I'm curious if we would be pushing fashion or watches as items forward in the same way, if not for all of this stuff happening in the background. I kind of understand the counter to that as well. It's not really stylists anymore. It's brands pushing an agenda nowadays. So I think I understand like the counter argument, but I just wanted to pose this as kind of a potential counter argument to, oh, boohoo, brands and stylists have ruined everything.
Stylists haven't, but they kind of have. Stylists, the stylist job, I mean, it really depends on the celebrity. Like, sometimes it's a partnership, you know, and the person has a lot of opinions and they have a lot of personal style, and it's like a collaborative effort. And you can see that. You can see when that happens, that you can see it with people like Timothée Chalamet or Rihanna or whoever. Like, they're people that would just naturally be cool anyway. And then you have the people who really need like the full squad to do the like full thing. And the stylists are kind of pushing the agenda. Like, I'm sure Bad Bunny would never have come to like wear small watches if it weren't for his stylist. So in that sense, like, it is important. But then, you know, there are stylists who probably take a check from brands for like, you know, that's how it works. Like, the celeb will take a cut and so will the stylist. Like, everybody's getting a piece of the pie. And I think we just have to be kind of transparent about that. But it's definitely the brands who kind of create these contracts where they dictate, like, I don't know, Margot Robbie is wearing Chanel and she has to have her hair tucked behind her ears so you can see the earrings. And she has to do like the kind of pose with the arm. And it's very like, it's kind of crazy. It's all very contractual.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, not the first thing that lawyers and contracts have ever ruined, speaking from experience.
Yeah.
My question here is like, what is ruined exactly? Because I think it's still, I know they're not wearing their personal watches. Like, obviously I get it. I think it's still quite interesting to see which celebrities are like mailing it in, or which are like Jean-Baptiste picking a Privé Cartier. You know, like, I still think that's interesting, even though they're not wearing their personal watches, whether it's the stylist, whether it's the celebrity's taste, I don't really care. I think it's funny and sort of absurd to see which celebrities throw on the latest release because the brand told them to, and which celebrities are like, no, I'm not wearing that. I'm wearing a Ladies Crash.
I think, you know, watch, like, what feels ruined is like watches, as we all know, are a very personal thing, and it's a matter of expression one way or another. And when it gets so commercialized, I think what feels ruined is that expression feels like it's taken away. It's like, it's no longer about any sort of bigger theme. It's like these watches feel like they become shoehorned into these scenarios when otherwise it would be like a really interesting, like, oh, just like we just were talking about, we got really excited that maybe for a second Jerry Seinfeld was wearing a Chanel J12, but then, oh, well, he's wearing Chanel, so they probably gave that to him. Like, it becomes less exciting that he didn't potentially he didn't choose it for himself. It was chosen for him. And that feels less fun and interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that point. And I should have put a caveat on this whole thing, this whole take, as like, listen, it's 2024. Everyone is getting paid to do something. So like, let's just realize that and have fun with what the current state of it is, because Robert Redford's not showing up in his red sub anymore. Like, that's just not what's going to happen in this year.
Yeah, I think for watches, to be brutally honest, I care a lot less about the placements than the clothes. Like, the clothes to me are just, I get very sad about it. But the watches, like, you know what, like, pick up your check and wear your IWC, like, good for you.
Malaika, can I ask you what makes you sad about the clothes?
Yeah, it's like, especially for something like the Met Gala, like, you should have sort of like freedom to go as crazy as you want to go. And I feel like what starts to happen is that, you know, everything just looks the same, and it's kind of like a trickle down effect. And it's like every arena just starts to look kind of, you know, whether it's like, I don't know, kids on TikTok or whatever, it's just like there is no diversity of thought. And it's like, all really comes from these like holding companies, right? It's like LVMH telling everybody what to wear. It's like, especially for a red carpet like the Met Gala, when you should be like celebrating, this is like so cringy, but you should be like celebrating fashion, but you're like coming to the carpet in the most like boring Dior gown because that's what you have to do as per your contract.
That's right. We're all celebrating the Costume Institute, right? We should be costumizing things.
Yeah. Shout out to, like, I mean, it just 20 years ago, it would have just been a different story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that was a good conversation. We do these watch spottings, you know, every red carpet season, we dutifully post these because, The reality is people want to see what celebrities are wearing, placed or not. And we do them every season, but I just wanted to use this as an opportunity to zoom out and talk about the ecosystem a little bit more. And I know, Malaika, you play in that world a lot. So thank you for that. Thank you to everyone. I think we're going to have to leave it there. As promised, I think we got to about 5 of the 10 Q&A questions I had listed out. So we're keeping some in the holster for a future episode. But thank you all for playing along. Thank you, Jonathan, Rich, and Malaika. We'll be back next week. We're going to be doing a bit of an auction recap type of thing, but because it'll be a little bit delayed just because of our recording schedule, it'll be a little bit zoomed out, and I've got guests Eric Koo and Justin Grunberg scheduled to come on, so hopefully we'll have some good auction market and just general vintage watch fun discussion. So thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to our editor, Vic Ottomanelli, and I'll see you again next week.